Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to hear from an expert. And today's expert really took what could have been what was a very painful experience in her life, but certainly could have really sent her into a downward spiral and turned it around for herself and for others in order to really create a significant and important company and service. I am very happy to introduce to you Joanna Conti. Now, Joanna, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Joanna, you have said that your interest in the addiction treatment field was really sparked by a very personal experience in your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. My husband and I have four children, and one of our daughters developed a really frighteningly serious problem with alcohol. And she was in and out of addiction treatment for a number of years. And you know, when you're thrown into something like this, you have no idea what to do. You know, your child, who you love more than life itself, is suddenly doing something that has a very large chance it's going to kill them. And, you know, you're very, very frightened, and you don't know where to turn.
You know, one of the things that I would say is, you know, in a lot of ways it depends on the family, because there are some families where alcoholism is an issue that they don't identify as an issue. And so things can progress for a while until they have absolutely reached beyond frightening proportions. But it sounds like you really began to recognize that there was something happening with your daughter. You said that she was regularly drinking to lethal levels and needed repeated bouts of expensive residential treatment. So that's one of the issues about residential treatment, is it not? It can be difficult to find, and when you do find it, it can be extraordinarily expensive.
Yes, it is. And fortunately, our daughter has been able, after six horrendous years, to turn her life around and has recently celebrated 4 years of sobriety. So we are incredibly blessed. But, you know, back when this was all happening for us, which was like 2008 to 2013, that was before the Affordable Care Act, and we never had insurance pay a penny of any of the treatment that our daughter needed. And so it was a very expensive time, very frightening. And I think what happens with most families is you think, well, this is just a phase. You know, you think, well, you know, I drank in college and, you know, it wasn't a problem, and you grow out of it. And I think there's a tremendous amount of wishful thinking that you do, saying, you know, well, you know, this isn't a big problem. And then things just get worse and worse and worse, and then you're finally confronted with, you know, something that you can't avoid, noticing that this is this is very severe and life-threatening.
Many situations like this, though, can result in family members and friendships really falling apart. And it sounds like, though, for you, it almost became a call to action. And one of the organizations that you created is Conquer Addiction. Can you tell us about Conquer Addiction?
Sure. Well, you know, when you're thrown into a situation like this with one of your children, and in our case, as I said, it lasted, you know, more than 5 years, where we would think our daughter was doing well, she'd be in treatment, she'd go to sober living, she'd be out on her own, things would plummet back down again, and, you know, we would go through the cycle again and again. You know, you learn a lot through the process, and when our daughter, you know, had her final episode, where she realized over the course of several weeks, she realized that her body was shutting down. She was actually going to die. And she went into an ER and had, you know, blood alcohol levels higher than, you know, you almost ever hear about. And, you know, I went down and got her and got her back into sober living. And this time she had made the decision. She's like, she finally recognized herself. Her choice was death or sobriety. And but I think she was only able to make that recognition and have the skill set to, you know, to stay sober because of the different treatment episodes she had had. But, you know, what I learned as a parent is that, you know, there's very little information out there. It's alcoholism or drug addiction is something that people tend not to talk about. So even if your neighbor next door had a child that had gone through this, you probably wouldn't know because there's such a stigma that people don't talk about it. And so one of the things after our daughter had turned the corner and had been sober for a couple of years, I thought I wanted to give back by providing advice for other parents and places they could look to find the best treatment centers. So I started Conquer Addiction as a way of one parent who'd been through this to help other parents. And we have a number of different ways that if you go to the conquer-addiction.org website, there's a number of different things that will be helpful, including an ebook that we produced. I interviewed a number of other parents who'd also been through this, some of whom's kids were doing well and some of whom's kids were still addicts on the street, and turned it into an ebook called Worried Your Son or Daughter Might Have a Problem with Drugs or Alcohol. And if this is helpful to anyone, we cover everything from, you know, what are the warning signs to how do you start talking about it? What do you do while you're hoping your child can turn this around himself or herself? And then what do you do if your child needs treatment? How do you find the right treatment? And how do you convince your child to go to treatment? And then after treatment, what is helpful in helping your child remain clean and sober? And meanwhile, how do you take care of yourself through this whole thing? So if any of your listeners are interested, if that would be helpful to them, they could go to worried-ebook.com and download a copy of this for free.
All right, and that's worried-ebook.com.
Right, like worried about your son or daughter.
Right.
Worried-ebook.com.
Okay.
Yes.
How do you begin to tell that your child might be having a difficulty?
Well, oftentimes you see a lot of changes in the child. You know, maybe their interests change, the friends that they have change, something that they used to love. Maybe they used to love playing tennis or hockey or something, and now they just can't really be bothered by it. Oftentimes you see either sudden weight loss or sudden weight gain. You might see nosebleeds. That might come from snorting meth or cocaine. You might see nodding off. Often you'll see a major drop in their performance in school. They may stop taking care of themselves. Things are, you know, they start acting weird or they start smelling different. Sometimes you might notice that things start to go missing, money or prescription drugs or something. You know, there tend to be, I think, a lot of signs, and I think all of us as parents want to believe the best. We believe it couldn't possibly be our child, but eventually, you know, these signs will get more severe, and then at some point, you know, if unfortunately your child is going in that direction, you might start, you know, having car accidents or incidents of alcohol poisoning or overdoses or, you know, horrendous things like that.
To all things that are really scary. Now, your daughter was how old when you began to seek out treatment for her?
Well, we started to realize she might have a problem about 18, and then we convinced ourselves for a while it was fine. It was a very, very frightening time. At one point, we had even gotten a call, a very upset call from somebody who was also in the family, saying that our daughter was walking around campus midday smelling of alcohol on a regular basis, and she had a serious problem. And so when she came home for Christmas, we took her to a therapist who said, "Oh, don't worry. Everyone drinks in college, you know." And we use that to, you know, give ourselves, you know, faith to hold on for another couple of months, thinking, "Oh, well, this really isn't a problem." But eventually, with our daughter, she ended up in a serious car accident and was taken by helicopter to shock trauma. And I think that was the night we realized, you know, this isn't a phase. This isn't going away.
Right.
You know, she's got a serious problem, and we need to help her find out how. And we tried different outpatient treatments, and eventually she had another car accident, and we realized that she really needed residential treatment. And that was the first of several major residential treatment episodes that she went through over the next 5 years.
Really sorry to hear about that therapist who gave you not quality information.
It was so upsetting. You know, I'm afraid that's one of the things parents should be aware of. Just because somebody is a therapist does not mean they're trained in addiction.
Exactly.
Addiction is a very different thing. And alcoholics or drug addicts, you know, that drug or that alcohol is so important to that person. They can't imagine living without it. So they tend to become very good at lying and at convincing people that they're doing better than they are. And if a therapist or someone hasn't been trained in addiction, they may not recognize what's really going on.
That is such a critical point that you make. Every therapist is not trained in every issue, and it is more than reasonable to ask the therapist what his or her training consists of, and if they have specific training in the area that you are seeking help with, whether it's addiction or whatever it is. It's really important to do research. Speaking of research, talk to us about VISTA Research Group. What is that about?
Well, I had another piece that we were doing as part of the Conquer Addiction that led me into creating yet another company. And that was that one of the things that I was so upset about during the time I was trying to find treatment for my daughter is that I was regularly put in a position, always in a crisis situation, where I had to find treatment for my daughter. Immediately, her life was at stake. And so, you know, somebody would recommend this center or that center, and I was forced repeatedly to agree to shell out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, always on the basis of a phone call with somebody who sounded nice and said, "Trust me, we're better than the rest." Right? And so your child's life is at stake, but how do you choose where is the right place to send them? And so after my daughter was doing better, I decided as part of Conquer Addiction that I wanted to create a website where people could search for treatment centers, but the ones that had the best success rates would show up at the top of the search. So you might say, you know, I want to find a treatment center in the Northeast, and I want it to serve adolescents, and I want it to take Blue Cross. But all of the treatment centers that met your criteria would show up in a search. But the ones that track and report their success rates would show up at the top. So you would have, you know, something on which to base this crucial decision. So we created that as part of Conquer Addiction, but then we ran into the problem that out of hundreds of treatment centers that we contacted, only 5 of them were tracking and reporting their success rates. And so I started going to different addiction conferences and talking to treatment centers and saying, you know, why aren't you doing this? You know, it's so important to know, are people able to stay sober for, you know, a month, 6 months, a year after treatment if they go to your treatment center? And why aren't you tracking this? And what I heard over and over again was people say, yes, we want to. It's in next year's strategic plan. We know we need to do this. We don't have a clue how to do this. Well, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've started half a dozen different companies over the years, one of which was a software company, and another was an international nonprofit. And I thought, you know, this isn't rocket science. We can figure out how to provide outcomes research to treatment centers at a reasonable price and with an independent, from an independent standpoint so that the data is believable. And so that's what I originally founded Vista Research Group to do, to provide this kind of outcomes research to addiction treatment centers.
Hearing you talk about the numbers of treatment centers who didn't have a research component, didn't have data available, you know, is kind of scary. Because as you said, people who are seeking treatment are sort of left to whatever their gut feeling is about whatever they have heard from whomever they have talked to on the phone, who may or may not be a seasoned clinician.
Right. Or you know, the people who are doing admissions for treatment centers, you know, oftentimes they will have a background in recovery themselves. But they're salespeople, and you know, they're very empathetic. I mean, I didn't talk to many that, you know, I didn't think, you know, really cared about my daughter and our problem. But they're paid to be salespeople, and you know, it's the addiction treatment industry seems to be, actually the whole behavioral healthcare industry is quite far behind regular healthcare in terms of measuring outcomes and basing, you know, decisions on what is the most effective therapy and so forth on hard data. It's just addiction and behavioral healthcare. It's just a number of years behind the rest of healthcare in using hard data to make decisions and to track outcomes.
One of the things that you said to us earlier that we're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about a bit more is your family and what was happening within your family as your daughter was going through the challenges that she was experiencing. You said she was one of 4 children, so you had 3 other children who weren't living the way your daughter was, but living it nevertheless. You had a spouse, again, who was probably top of the head deep in all of the trauma and the concerns that were going on in your family at the time. So we're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'd like to start with that.
Sure.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Joanna Conti of the Vista Research Group. We'll be right back. Joanna, tell us about your other three children. What was their reaction to what was happening with your daughter?
There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of concern. You know, we had, you know, she had two sisters who were older and a younger brother. And it was a very, very difficult time for the whole family. One of the wonderful things about good treatment centers is that they usually encourage the family to come in after the child has been in treatment for, you know, a while, multiple weeks or something. They'll often schedule a 2 to 5 day family session, because a lot of times the problems that addiction has happened has caused in the family are so severe. You know, it just rips families apart. You know, brothers and sisters can't trust their own sibling, and parents will oftentimes disagree about, you know, should you really be spending, you know, X number of dollars, and at what point is, you know, should you do tough love and, you know, just write, you know, say that that child, you know, it's good money after bad. And so there's, it's very, very disruptive to the family. And we had, you know, very similar problems. We had, you know, my husband and I had some pretty serious disagreements as the bills kept, you know, rising and rising. And, you know, but yet you feel like it's, you know, this is your child. Their life is at stake. You know, how can you say, well, we won't do this? And so, I don't know, it's a very, very difficult time. And I think family programs can be very helpful when a child is going through treatment.
You also referenced, speaking of concerns about the bills as they were mounting, that your family was literally laying out thousands and thousands of dollars for treatment. And it sort of, at least in my mind, underscores the critical need for there to be treatment that is covered by insurance policies and covered beyond, you know, a 7 day or a 14 day detox.
Exactly. And I think things have changed quite a bit. I mean, again, we've been so blessed that our daughter has been sober for 4 years now. So I don't have recent experience with trying to get insurance coverage. But what I do hear from our clients that are treatment centers is that, you know, they might get an okay for 10 days or 14 days from an insurance company. And then after that, they have to justify every day or two extra. They have to prove to the insurance company that they should keep spending money on treating this person. And yet the data is crystal clear that you have to be in treatment usually for, you know, a significant period of time, typically at least 3 or 4 weeks, before your mind starts to clear from all of, you know, the impacts of the drugs and alcohol you've had. And so, you know, you're probably not thinking real clearly at 2 weeks sober. And are you really going to be able to step back and, you know, and look at this horrendous drug or alcohol that's calling to you and say, you know, that the consequences are so severe that I'm going to stay away? I mean, certainly some people are able to do it in a couple of weeks. Some people are able to do it without residential treatment or just by going to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. I'm not saying treatment is always required, but if it is, and you're only able from your insurance to get coverage for 10 days or 14 days, I think the odds are against that person being able to stay sober long term.
Well,
and that's really sad.
It is sad, and it's frightening for the society at large, I would say, particularly with the kind of addictions that we're talking about where the substances are so readily available.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, I was working in a treatment facility, and it was $1,000 plus a day. That was years ago. And that's not in the scheme of things out of the ballpark in terms of what some of the facilities cost. And when you think about all of the staff that goes into working with that individual, you know, it's a lot of money, but it kind of makes sense when you look at all the people who are involved in treatment.
Yes. The treatment centers that our daughter went to were in that range, yes.
And so if you don't have the financial resources to do that, you may have the will, but if you don't have the resources, you might be in a bit of trouble. You might be in a lot of trouble for yourself as well as your family.
Right. And there are, there are state-funded programs. There are reasonably priced treatment programs with grants available. Some treatment programs will do a sliding scale based on income. I'm not saying there's no hope if you can't pay. There certainly has come a long way,
yes,
in the 4 years since our daughter was going through this. But there's a long way to go, too. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, there was an act of Congress called the Parity Act that said that insurance companies needed to treat addiction and behavioral health using the same processes that they look at physical health. And, in fact, even though this has been the law of the country for, I'm thinking since 2008, but it may not be exactly that time, there's still a lot of insurance companies that aren't following that, and there have been recently some large settlements, I think, in New York and other places where, you know, attorney generals and others have said, wait a minute, this is the law, you need to follow it. But there's still a real difference between the coverage and the hoops they make you jump through for addiction treatment versus some other if you had a heart attack or something.
There have long been and continue to be some biases with respect to the treatment of mental health issues, including addiction issues, even though that kind of treatment is actually what allows people who need it to be healthy and to function in society. But that's a whole other conversation.
Yes, it is.
Let's talk about the different types of treatment. As you've said, not everyone needs to be in residential care. So there's outpatient, there is residential, there's partial hospitalization, transitional housing, something that you talked about, the sober living. Can you give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of how those different treatment options, what they are like, what makes them different?
Sure. Residential care is usually you're going off-site to some place that's taking you away from the people, places, and things that trigger your use, and you're, in a protected environment for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 months. It varies. And that, as you said, is, as you'd expect, quite expensive. There's also outpatient, and it's usually called intensive outpatient, an abbreviated IOP. And these are programs that you'll typically go to 3 or 4 days a week, maybe for 3 to 5 hours a day. And you're in group therapy and individual therapy, but you're going back home or someplace at the end of the day. Sometimes this is combined with sober living, and it's called PHP-IOP oftentimes. That's partial hospitalization intensive outpatient, where you're going to a treatment setting during the day, and then you're being transported to, a sober living environment for, to stay. One of the things that's strongly recommended is after you get out of a treatment like a residential program, that you do not just return back to college or to, the neighborhood you were living before, because you're just going to be reminded you know, every time you, you know, walk down the street, oh, that's where I shot up, and that's where my, you know, that's, here's my phone, I can call my dealer, and stuff like that. And I realize how difficult that is for a lot of families. You know, what I'm saying is not easy for anyone, but right. If you can, you know, find a strong, sober living environment, to go to after residential treatment, I think that helps tremendously. So those are kind of the big ones: residential, IOP, sober living, and oftentimes you follow a continuum of care is recommended. That you know, as you've been sober longer, you can step down to less intensive treatment, and you know, get maybe get a job, and you know, get more back into your, you know, a regular life.
What's your experience of sober living facilities, and can someone research sober living facilities by going to your website as well?
We haven't added sober living facilities. We've been thinking about it at some point. But what we really want with the Conquer Addiction website is we want to get to the point where a lot more treatment centers are tracking and reporting their outcomes so that the search function is more valuable. If you can only find five that are, you know, we haven't done much promotion to send people to that site because, you know, that's not going to help that many people, those particular five. So we've moved to, you know, doing outcomes research for other treatment facilities and actually doing during treatment research also to help patients get better faster through VISTA Research Group. But, you know, at some point I hope to be able to have the sober living component as part of Conquer Addiction because I think there's a tremendous variation in those two. Maybe even more variation in sober living environments than there is in treatment. I mean, you hear such horror stories of some places.
Yes.
And yet I know from my daughter's experience that, you know, other places were, you know, very, very helpful. And I'm convinced she wouldn't be sober today if it weren't for one sober living home that she stayed in for over a year, actually.
Well, you've got at least one vote to add that to your to the website when the time is right, because you're right. I mean, I've heard horror stories about some sober living environments. And that's, you know, when you've gone through, in my view, when you've gone through all the work such that you are now clinically appropriate for a sober living environment, please let it be a sober living environment that can actually support the work that you've done.
Right. And unfortunately, you know, sober living homes, you know, everybody who's there is in some stage of recovery and some of them are relapsing. And so, you know, they will eventually get kicked out supposedly, but you know, I mean, it's a risky place if it's not well managed.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Let's talk more about the research that you're doing. There's a connection with the Joint Commission. What exactly is the Joint Commission?
Well, the Joint Commission is an accreditation organization. People may be familiar with it in terms of accrediting hospitals. They are creating a standard of quality. They're saying that this is a quality program, and there's a lot of work that a treatment center has to go through in order to earn the Joint Commission accreditation. And by the way, there's also another one, a CARF accreditation, which a lot of addiction facilities get. You know, they're both good accreditations, but the Joint Commission has taken it a little bit further this year, and they are now requiring that all of addiction treatment or behavioral health centers start monitoring how patients are doing during treatment, and preferably with patient-reported data. Now, what we're doing in addition to our outcome study is we are providing a service called Insight Addiction and Insight Behavioral, where when patients come into treatment, they are screened. Everything is done online, and they are screened for different co-occurring disorders like depression, anxiety, trauma, eating disorders. We screen them for suicidal thoughts and behaviors and self-harming behaviors. Are they cutting themselves? That sort of thing. We also find out a lot about what brought them to treatment. You know, if they're in addiction treatment, what was their primary drug of choice? How much were they using? What was their addiction severity? And we also look at a lot of different quality of life measures. What was their life like before they came to treatment? And then while they're in treatment, the patients come back, fill out our online survey typically every week, and we can track the severity of the symptoms of depression or PTSD or, you know, making themselves vomit if they have an eating disorder. And we can identify, you know, that they should be, you would assume, steadily improving during the time they're in treatment, and most of them do. But one of the advantages of this type of research is that it's particularly good at identifying those patients that aren't progressing as expected and making it very clear to their counselors so that the counselors can be, very aware that, well, you know, they came in severely depressed, they got a little bit better, but now they've been the same for the last couple of weeks, and maybe we need to consider doing something different. So the research behind this type of progress monitoring, measurement-based care, it has a lot of different names. The research is so powerful that this helps patients get better faster during treatment that the Joint Commission has now required that all of their accredited behavioral health and addiction treatment centers start offering this and using it to inform clinical care during the time that patients are in treatment. And so we now have a program that we have developed to make this very easy for treatment centers to do. Everything is done online. We can reach out to the patients directly if they have access to a smartphone or the internet, and all the counselors have to do is log in and see the results, and it's, you know, in color-coded graphs that make it very easy to see who's doing well and who could maybe use another change.
Sounds like your software background has stood you in good stead.
Yes, it has. That's one advantage of having started a number of different companies. And I'm a chemical engineer by training with a master's in international business. I've run for office. I mean, I have such a diverse background. It's absolutely crazy. But I feel like maybe all of this came together to help me launch this company, because I think this is going to really change lives.
Well, it sounds like it will. And I do note that you identify yourself as a recovering politician. I think that is yet another conversation. Right now, Joanna, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to hear more about the studies that you've just, the research that you've just described. So we'll be right back, folks. Don't go away. Joanne, I'd like to go back just for a moment and get a little bit more information about the Joint Commission, because again, I suspect that a lot of people who are not in the medical mental health field have never heard of the Joint Commission. It is an independent nonprofit organization, but the value of having the Joint Commission accreditation is, if you again would repeat, what that value is to the consumer.
Sure. Well, if an organization has been accredited by the Joint Commission, you know that they're following certain quality and safety standards, that they have been through an intensive, survey where they had to provide a lot of proof that they were following best practices, and they have to continue to comply with the best practices that the Joint Commission recommends. And this is one. So, among the centers that have been accredited by the Joint Commission or by CARF, you know that they have gone the extra mile to show that, that they want to be considered one of the best treatment facilities in the country by applying for and complying with all the various requirements that accreditation entails.
And what does CARF stand for?
Oh, dear. Commission for the Accredit... I'm not sure. It's CARF.
It'll be our secret.
Commission on the Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, I think.
Very good. That's very good. Now, I know with the Joint Commission that getting the accreditation and certification can be financially costly. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Yes. Usually they'll hire various consultants. They'll have to have a team that's working to pull together the data that the Joint Commission requires. And then there's on-site surveys and, and again, anytime you're complying with many best practices, I mean, the manual is quite thick. I think it's maybe an inch thick. It's very meaningful when a treatment center goes through the process of getting accreditation.
And even the manual is several hundred dollars. So what kind of thought should someone have if they're looking at a facility and it doesn't have Joint Commission accreditation? Does that mean that they're not up to snuff? Does that mean they're not large enough to be able to afford it? What does it mean?
No, I don't think you can take that away. It's Joint Commission and CARF, and the CARF tends to be a lot more common on the West Coast, and I'm not really sure why. I think Joint Commission is often considered the more prestigious accreditation, and I base that on the fact that I think some states are requiring that their organizations become Joint Commission accredited. I've been trying to find out how much it costs to do that. I think it's somewhere by the time you do everything that's required, it's tens of thousands, if not higher than that an organization has invested in the accreditation process.
So clearly there might be smaller organizations that are really well run, but they don't have the thousands of dollars that it would take in order to get the Joint Commission accreditation. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is. And realize that there are state certifications also, and some of those state certification programs are pretty entailed also. So before I sent somebody to a treatment center, my preference would be to have them be Joint Commission accredited, but CARF is also strong, but at least they need to be accredited by their state certification organization.
How does one find out whether or not the facility being considered is accredited?
It's almost always a logo on the bottom of their homepage. They're proud of these accreditations and certifications.
Okay. So it's not a secret if they've gone through the process and been able to achieve it.
No, I would be fairly certain if someone's gone through the Joint Commission accreditation, they're showing the gold seal on their website.
Might even be wearing T-shirts.
Maybe.
Let's turn our attention back to the Insight Addiction and Insight Behavioral research that you talked about. Now, these are self-report studies.
Yes.
How accurate would you say the responses are, given that we already know that folks who are dealing with addictions, whether consciously or unconsciously, have a tendency to lowball the degree of the addiction? How accurate are these self-reports?
That's not what we're finding.
Ah,
I mean,
okay.
the people who are in addiction treatment, I will say, like, for our addiction severity questionnaire, you can answer 11 different questions, yes or no. And I will tell you that the vast majority of the people who are taking this survey are answering all or almost all of them positively. So we're not seeing that they're minimizing the impact the addiction has had on them. There's always exceptions to any rule. I remember one person who I think he had several different DUIs, and he'd been in jail, and he was drinking, I think he was 20 drinks a day or something, but he didn't think he had a problem. So, you know, there's always going to be, you know, some people who, you know, are in complete denial even when they're in treatment. But, you know, we're not seeing a problem so much with the surveys during treatment. And realize that we're focusing on, you know, they're different co-occurring disorders as much as anything else when we're doing the ongoing research while they're in treatment. So we're you know, most people who come into an addiction treatment facility will be suffering from depression or anxiety or trauma or all three of the above. Probably maybe a third will be suffering from an eating disorder. There's a lot of things that come together. Few people are going to be in addiction treatment without having any of these underlying mental or physical disorders. So that's really what we're tracking is while they're in treatment. We're tracking the strength and frequency of cravings. We're tracking their relationships, the quality of their relationships with their family members. We're tracking how satisfied are they with treatment. And because of this type of research with some of our early clients, we've been able to identify in a number of cases issues that the treatment center wasn't aware of. For example, one of our early treatment centers discovered that a lot of their clients were suffering from some pretty severe eating disorders, and they hadn't been aware of it. But now that they knew, they were able to bring in an eating disorder specialist who could separately bill Medicaid. And because she was there having meeting with the patients one-on-one and also in group sessions, suddenly the whole atmosphere around eating disorders changed at this treatment center. And what had been very hush-hush and no one talked about it, suddenly people were talking about their problems with, binge eating or with making themselves vomit or stuff like that. And then other patients came forward to their counselors and said, you know, can I meet with that eating disorder counselor too? Because I have a problem. And so it just changed the total awareness of eating disorders and the willingness of the patients to admit they had one and to seek out help. So it can be just, you know, phenomenally useful.
Well, and the other thing that I'm hearing is that the facilities are actually having an opportunity to treat the whole individual. You know, it's easy to look at somebody who has an addiction as that person just has that addiction and there's nothing else going on. But there's always something else going on. You just may not know what it is.
Right. Exactly. Another case, it was one of our very earliest clients and one of our earliest patients. It was an adolescent boy who had been in outpatient treatment for some time. And the treatment center a clinician knew that something wasn't quite right. You know, he wasn't doing as well as she expected him to. She had even sent him for a psychological assessment saying, you know, I think he needs more. And the assessment came back saying, no, he's fine. And so as soon as we started doing Insight Addiction there, we discovered that he was dealing with incredibly high levels of anxiety and PTSD symptoms. He was not fine. There was a reason he was struggling to stop using. And so armed with this information, the counselor could go send him back to a psychiatric care and, you know, I'm sure just an individual therapist, and say he's not fine. He needs something additional. And I don't know what happened after that. I don't know if he went on medication or, you know, they talk therapy or what exactly they started to do after that. But I can tell you that his level of symptoms of those two things went down. So, you know, that's the sort of advantage that by providing progress monitoring or measurement-based care or, you know, there's all sorts of different names by which this type of patient-reported research goes by. But that's the reason that the Joint Commission has required that treatment facilities start doing this, because the research shows that it has an overwhelming impact and that, you know, in most of the clinical trials, it helps patients get better faster if their counselors can see in front of them, these are some of the other issues that this person is struggling with, and are they getting better or not?
That makes such perfect sense. And clearly, if somebody is not improving in the way that you would imagine, there's more information that you need to have in front of you in order to really be able to assist. You mentioned PTSD a couple of times. I just want to acknowledge that that stands for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And you will be happy to know that you were very correct when you gave us the definition for CARF. It stands for Commission on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities. So good for you.
Google works again.
I'm telling you, you're getting an A+ all over the place. The services that you provide, are they specific to organizations? Are they available to large organizations, or are they available to private practices or smaller facilities?
Absolutely, they are. We're very, very reasonably priced. You know, the reason I created this company and, you know, have worked with developers for the last over a year to develop this research is because our mission is to develop the data that will help treatment centers improve the treatments that they're providing. And eventually, as we get data on, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of patients, the data that we're collecting is going to be very useful for researchers to identify, you know, what are the things that are most important in addiction treatment. And, you know, the data that we're developing, I think, over time could really help the whole industry move forward. And so we're trying to make sure that it's as easy to use as possible and as reasonably priced as possible so that, you know, all the centers out there can use it.
When I'd like to go back to the site that offers folks information on how to conduct a search, Conquer Addiction. you've indicated that you can search, you need to take a look at price and whether or not they cover insurance and the insurance that you have, treatment type, and the special programs that you may be interested in. Are there other things that one should look at in doing a search for a facility that's suitable for the person you're trying to assist?
I would look for, do they have a joint commission or a CARF accreditation, because those are on the site also if they have it. But also, you know, sometimes this whole field is in a great transition, and new centers are opening up and closing down all the time. And so I would recommend that you know, people who are suddenly knowing that they need to find a treatment for a loved one, that they go to some of the family support groups and start talking to other people who've gone through it, and they might be able to give them firsthand information. You know, my spouse went here and it made a dramatic difference, or, you know, stay away from this place for, you know, for various reasons or whatever. And so I think it's important to reach out to other people who are struggling with something, you know, who've been down the same path, because they can give some really good advice.
Sounds terrific. Joanna, can you give us, again, information about your website or websites where people can go, both individuals, laypersons, as well as clinicians, as well as administrators who may be interested in learning more about what you're doing?
Sure. For Conquer Addiction, the website is conquer-addiction.org, and you'll see how to search for treatment centers. You can also, if you're mainly interested in the ebook, worried that your son or daughter might have a problem with drugs or alcohol, you can go to worried-ebook.com. Now, in terms of research, in terms of addiction treatment and behavioral health care treatment centers, VISTA Research Group's website is vista-research-group.com. And we also have a hot-off-the-presses ebook that talks about all the research that proves how effective progress monitoring is and how you can use it to improve treatment at your facility, and how you can use outcomes research, where we follow up with patients 1 month, 6 months, and 12 months afterwards, how you can use that to create a strategic plan to improve your whole treatment facilities program. And so that ebook, which is available on the VISTA website, but you can also get that ebook by going to outcomes-ebook.com. So outcomes-ebook.com. So I'm sorry to spout out all sorts of different web addresses, but it seems to be the easiest way to lead people to different things that might be helpful.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And VISTA is V-I-S-T-A, yes?
Yes.
All right. So that's vista-research-group.com.
Yes.
Thank you, Joanna Conti, so much for the work that you're doing, but certainly for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I really appreciate your interest.
Well, and I so much enjoy hearing about the work that you're doing and the energy that you put into the work that you're doing, which is clear. So I thank you again. I thank you again for that. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. And it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand as you choose by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or the Google Play Store. You can also go to iTunes and sign up for the daily Mind Talk podcast. So there are lots of ways to have Mind Talk available to you. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So by all means, send me an email email with any questions or comments to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.